And articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some articles from the January 2024 issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Hello, world. The groundbreaking production of Osseo TV spotlights the spirit of the Cherokee Nation. By Carrie A. Back. Storytelling has long been a cherished tradition within the Cherokee Nation, reflecting the rich cultural heritage of the nation. For generations, members of the tribe have passed down their legends, creation stories, wisdom, and culture through narratives and oral traditional stories. One of the largest Native American tribes in the U.S., the Cherokee Nation continues to embrace innovative forms of storytelling, including film and TV. Enter Osseo TV, an indigenous-created documentary-style television program featuring the people, places, history, and culture of the Cherokee Nation. The first-of-its-kind series is breaking barriers and helping change how Native Americans are represented by bringing the rich traditions and compelling modern stories of the Cherokee people to viewers across the globe. The power of storytelling is ingrained in Cherokee culture, and there's something truly remarkable and powerful in having the opportunity to tell our own story in a way that connects people to their very core, says Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskins, Jr. It is wonderful that now people across the United States can join us in experiencing that same overwhelming sense of belonging the show offers while celebrating our history, language, culture, and values. Few shows on the air in mainstream media have displayed accurate and authentic representation of Native Americans. Since premiering in 2015, Osseo is the first show created by an all-Native American team, highlighting Native-centered content that's educational and enjoyable for all audiences. The show focuses on compelling stories of the Cherokee heritage, culture, and leaders in the Native American community. Cherokee history and modern culture come alive in half-hour episodes profiling star athletes, talented musicians, and traditional artists. There are human interest stories and showcases of Cherokee national treasures, shining the light on citizens that preserve the language, traditions, art, and crafts of the tribe. When we approach the show and each segment of the show, we approach it in a way that is inclusive of people who are steeped in Cherokee culture and those who have never known anything about Cherokee culture, says Jennifer Lauren, executive producer and host. Not only is it an entertaining show, but it's also correcting a lot of false stereotypes and correcting a lot of ill-conceived notions about the Native Americans and Cherokee people are. And so it's something that we take a lot of pride in. Lauren, a Native Nation citizen and Emmy-winning journalist, has been in the TV and film industry since 2001. Behind the scenes, the production team consists of enrolled members of the Native American tribes, and the show is clearly a team effort. We're successful because of the team that we have and the passion that our team has, Lauren says. When I lead this organization, we try to maintain a community focus. Everything that we're doing is for a purpose. Our whole team and everybody plays a really important role in accomplishing our mission. Known for high production quality and combining engaging storytelling with visually stunning cinematography, Osseo TV has won multiple awards and accolades, including numerous Telly Awards and 22 regional Emmy Awards, with more than 35 nominations. Now in its 9th season, the show continues to pave the way for native-led stories. A favorite among fans of the show, as well as one of Lauren's most memorable episodes, is the Remember the Removal Bike Ride episode from Season 1. It provided a thoughtful coverage of young Cherokee cyclists who ride along one of the Trail of Tears routes, giving viewers the opportunity to learn about the tragic past that's part of the nation's history. The series is now available nationwide to more than 250 PBS member stations, and as well as on FNX, an all-native programming TV network, as well as other platforms like YouTube, Vimeo, Facebook, and Twitter. It is really incredible to see our series become nationally syndicated. OCO TV will now be available to hundreds of public TV stations across the U.S., bringing our authentic Cherokee stories into the living rooms of millions of people, many of whom have likely only known inaccurate accounts of Cherokee history and still believe stereotypes passed on by generations of non-native media and pulp culture references. Being on the air regionally for 8 seasons, garnering 22 Emmys, and now receiving national syndication, prove that there is a hunger for new and accurate portrayals of our people and our rich culture and history. Native Tongue. Osage author and Oklahoman Chelsea Hicks debuted her first book to rave reviews. CNI talks to her about writing and her fight to preserve heritage languages. By Heidi Brandes. At first glance, it's impossible not to see the heritage in writer and Tulsa artist fellow Chelsea T. Hicks' entire countenance. Her dark eyes swim with sincerity when she describes growing up in Virginia, away from Oklahoma's Osage Nation, of which she is a member. Her long dark hair is pulled back into a ponytail, showing off the long red and white beaded earrings by Mariah Redcorn that dangle from her earlobes, one of the subtle clues to her connection with her tribe and her history. Hicks won the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 honor, which recognizes writers from around the world under the age of 35 who have published their first and only book of fiction within the last 5 years. The honorees were recognized at a ceremony in May 2023 and presented with a $1,000 prize. It's a huge shock and an even bigger blessing, like a kiss on the forehead from the universe. At the celebratory event in May, I got to give some remarks to a big crowd at the Brooklyn Museum. It was very exciting. When I'd felt crushed, creatively speaking, by the struggle, receiving this award made me want to keep going as a writer. I hope this award might mean a translation of the book into other languages. The National Book Foundation honor is just the beginning of an auspicious and varied career, if the packed summer that followed is any indication. Hicks is in a documentary called Un Pont au-dessus de l'Ocean, A Bridge Over the Ocean, which follows two women, one of whom is Hicks, who compose in their own ancestral languages of Occitan and Wasashi, and draws attention to the interconnection between language and land. The film, which is by Francis Forcou, tells the story of an unlikely connection between two places, Occitania, an ancient region in the south of France, and the Osage Reservation. Osages share their culture and language story in their own words with the Occitan visitor. And when an Osage writer learns more of Occitan language and culture, ultimately showing the inspiration we can provide to each other in carrying on our own work. The documentary was confirmed to debut as an official selection at the 33rd International First Peoples Festival in Montreal in August 2023. Her sincerity when discussing her prose, which focuses on the modern and ancient struggles of Native women, and her work to help preserve the heritage language of the Osage people, is only enhanced by an unearthly calm beauty that she exudes. Although she grew up in Virginia, Hicks never let go of her Osage Nation roots. She spent summers in the Oklahoma Rez border town of Bartlesville, near the Osage Nation with her Iko, or grandmother, and began studying the Wasashi, that is, or language, of her tribe as a tribute to her Iko. After living in the Bay Area in California, where she earned a master's degree at UC Davis and a master's of fine arts at the Institute of American Indian Arts in creative writing, Hicks's debut book, A Calm and Normal Heart, was long listed in 2023 for the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize for Debut Short Story Collection, which honors an exceptionally talented fiction writer whose debut book, a collection of short stories, represents distinguished literary achievement and suggests great promise for a second work of literary fiction. The stories focus mostly on Osage women, exploring themes like their relationships with men, their sense of belonging, how they perceive themselves, and how they are mistreated and ignored by society and those around them. "It's wild," she says. "It's not just a distinguished, respectable award. It's one of the major ones. For me, being long listed for this establishes this way for me as a writer. And it's cool from the Native perspective because Penn is all about fine speech and equity." Hicks is a Native Arts and Culture Foundation 2021 LIFT awardee and a Past Writing by Writers Fellow, a 2016 Wasashi Woman Artist featured by the Osage Nation Museum, and a 2020 finalist for the Eliza So Fellowship for Native American Women Writers. In her stunning debut book, Hicks created the first book of contemporary literary writing to incorporate the Wasashi orthography and Latinized characters in addition to English. As a former staffer at Deposka Ondokapi, the Osage Nation's educational facility helping Osage children learn the Osage language, and a host of indigenous language creative writing workshops, Hicks, who is currently at work on a novel based on two stories from A Calm and Normal Heart, talked to CI about her journey as both an author and a student of heritage languages. In an elusive conversation, she spoke in her quiet and insistent voice about her experiences as a Native writer and as a Native woman striving to be seen as a modern person and not just an anachronistic idea. "You live in Tulsa. What drew you back to Oklahoma?" "When I was doing my Master's of Fine Arts at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, that's when it lit up my eyes for the first time that, oh, people on the res really think differently of those who don't live there. In our culture, there are certain aspects you can't learn if you don't live here. And I didn't really realize that before because I was treated with respect by those who knew me. It just made me realize I have a responsibility if I'm going to carry on my heritage to do more and learn more. I didn't realize at the time it was also causing me mental health problems, which I had always had. I had a really, really intense feeling of not belonging. When I'm here in Oklahoma, that just goes away. These are my people. I felt like I was home, and it was so powerful. But there was another aspect as well. I had taken this class and native poetry seminar when I was at UC Davis because I did two masters. I had done an MA and thought I wanted to teach, but you couldn't teach with an MA at the time. A lot of native people I knew were like, "You have to come do an MFA at the Institute of American Indian Arts." Our culture and those who have kept our culture, as well as our ability to welcome people back to reconnect to our land, is the one thing I was wanting to show in this book. I wanted to draw attention to the effects of disconnection from ancestral lands and not being able to access something that you identify with ancestrally, which for us is really land. Why is it important for you to promote and preserve the language? There is within the language a worldview that is very healing to Native people. It allows anybody who's living on that land to understand their relationship to the land. It provides a humongous comprehension of our deep interconnection between ourselves and the land. I think that language goes hand in hand with land protection and responsibility. As for art, I think that it helps with the worldview and the positionality of we have as Native people. In Oklahoma, we've gone from being forced boarding schools to contemporary schools. And with critical race theory being nearly banned in Oklahoma, now you don't even have access to an ancestral way of thinking. It's limited in how much we can think and learn. So learning the language allows the possibility of making the art that has our experiences and orientation. In this worldview, that's totally different. Could you talk a little about visibility for Native people and culture? There's so many Native people in Indian Territory, or what used to be Indian Territory in Oklahoma, but there is a newer visibility of Native art, Native works, and Native TV. As a Tulsa artist fellow, and as an Oklahoman, I get upset when I see Native people still being overlooked. And that is so habitual, because that's what federal policy was for Native people, to make sure with assimilation that we were not visible and that we were not talked about and that we were not part of the conversation. I want to encourage people. Reading Native books, especially by Native authors, has the power to get into your subconscious. You start thinking of Native people as contemporary and present and not just a piece of interesting history. I want to thank the constellation of people who are making it possible to think of Native people as here and now. Enforcing the law in Indian Territory as the first known black U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi, David Oyelowo takes the lead and the badge in the new series Lawman, Bass Reeves from Paramount. There's a New Marshal in Town by Wendy Wilkinson. A British-born prince of the Yoruba people of Nigeria, he might seem an unlikely actor to so convincingly inhabit quintessentially American figures on screen. But that's how good actor David Oyelowo is. He's already commanded big screen brilliantly portraying Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma, and he's now owning the smaller screen as Old West lawman Bass Reeves in executive producer Taylor Sheridan's new instant classic. Oyelowo downplays the African royalty thing. It sounds way more impressive than it actually is. There are so many royal families in Africa, he told The Independent, but there's no denying he's Hollywood royalty these days, even if he eschews the part. As that 2013 Independent article put it, and this on the heels of roles in Lincoln, Jack Reacher, and The Butler, He's descended from Nigerian royalty and was the Royal Shakespeare Company's first black Henry VI. Now, actor David Oyelowo's reign extends to Hollywood. Oh, and by 2016, he'd get to tack OBE on his name, having been made an officer of the Order of the British Empire in his native England for services to drama. Credit Oyelowo's upbringing with teaching him how to operate, you might say act, in vastly different worlds. Born in 1976 in Oxford, England, to Nigerian parents, he moved with his family to Lagos, Nigeria, at age 6 and went to a military-style boarding school there. Moving back to England at 16 to live in London, he grew up with his screen idols Sidney Poitier and Denzel Washington. A devout Christian, raised Baptist, his faith helped him understand and play Dr. King, who was an ordained Baptist minister. Moved by King's devotion to voting rights and by the experience of portraying King during the 1965 Civil Rights March from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, Oyelowo made up his mind to become an American. Now a dual citizen, he and his wife became naturalized U.S. citizens in 2016. While his 2014 role as King in the Academy Award and Golden Globe Award-winning Selma was a big breakout role with American audiences, Oyelowo also turned in a breathtaking solo performance that same year in HBO's Nightingale, the disturbingly gripping story of murderer Peter Snowden, who starts the story by confessing to the killing of his mother. Over the last decade, Oyelowo has been nominated for more than a dozen television and film awards, taking home the Critics' Choice Award for Best Actor in a Motion Picture for Nightingale, which also earned him a Golden Globe nomination for his work as executive producer on the movie, and an NAACP Image Award for his portrayal of King in Selma. In 2023, Oyelowo had the opportunity to play two lawmen, Sheriff Holston in Apple TV's post-apocalyptic sci-fi hit Silo, and as the historical Bass Reeves in the new 8-episode Paramount series Lawmen, Bass Reeves, which was created for television by showrunner, executive producer, and writer Chad Feehan, and executive produced by Taylor Sheridan and Oyelowo. The series tracks Reeves' rise from enslavement to law enforcement as the first known black U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi. Before the actor's strike, C&I had the opportunity to speak with Oyelowo about his film career, playing lawman and the real Bass Reeves. You recently said that Reeves is, to me, in that echelon of overcoming insurmountable odds to achieve unbelievable things, despite all of the challenges that were in his way. Tell us a bit about Bass Reeves. When I was first approached about the character, I didn't really know who he was, and I was a bit blown away that I didn't know who this historic lawman was. His life seemed like it would make a good television show, as when he was walking the earth, it was time when doing the things that he was able to do was most unthinkable. Before becoming the best known and most studied black marshal west of Mississippi, Reeves was enslaved during his early life and later fought in the Civil War, before escaping and gaining his freedom. What did you discover about these early years? Reeves learned so much from the Native Americans, especially the Seminoles, about tracking and living off the land. He then went on to be a farmer for 10 more years before embarking on this illustrious career as a lawman during the country's reconstruction after the Civil War. Sources vary on number, but it can be estimated that he went on to arrest more than 3,000 men, both black and white, for several decades during the Jim Crow period, which enforced racial segregation. The reality that someone like Bass Reeves became such a noted and successful lawman during that time was that the West was so lawless that white men didn't want to touch it, and Native Americans had learned how to live with it. As Reeves was just coming out of enslavement, the idea of being deputized was just incredible in relation to what he had been through before. Whether the criminals were white, black, or something in between, these men were angry and violent, and many were ex-Confederate soldiers going on a tear. We've read that you were trying to get the story of Bass Reeves made for 8 years. Why did it take so long? I didn't start working with Taylor Sheridan until a few years ago. I had another producing partner, and we, along with other collaborators, originally started pitching Reeves' show to studios and networks in 2015, before Paramount existed, and before Sheridan's emergence, and were told that no one was doing Westerns. We then went out with it again 2 years later, and were told that everyone was doing Westerns. It became clear that we were being fobbed off with excesses that made no sense. Several years later, Taylor came along and invigorated the Western. So I met with him and all that comes with that behemoth. But what really impressed me was his passion and tremendous knowledge about Bass Reeves and how significant he was. He is so well read and even knew more about Reeves than I did. He was the partner I was looking for, and I knew he could get this thing made. Did you participate in his renowned cowboy camp? Oh, yes. I did a few cowboy camps, one with the Yellowstone cast when they were gearing up for season 5, and I participated in a Bass Reeves cowboy camp as well. But the camps were the least of my riding, as I spent a lot of time personally in the saddle and had to get proficient in using a pistol. I never ever want to play a historical character without having the skills to pull it off, especially if the person's famous. You really must put in the time to make it work. How was it to work with Sheridan? Did he have a vision for Reeves as well as the limited series? You executive produced as well. Tell us a bit about wearing both hats. We had an amazing team who were able to build the show, and Taylor really is superhuman, being able to create such a well-oiled machine from the wranglers and set designers to the directors he has worked with and on his shows in the past, who are all so, so good. Another one of his major talents is his ability to put together major epic Western sets. We didn't have to reinvent the wheel because he had already set the table for us. I never thought I would be driving a mule or riding multiple horses, some of them rearing. What is so amazing about this team is that it would be impossible for me to do what Bass Reeves had to do if we had not been afforded the chance to corral the best crew possible. The same goes for the actors. It was very important for him to have black, Native American, brown, and white people tell these stories. Our production designer, head of makeup, head of hairstyling, and one of our directors on the show are black. These are the people who traditionally are not afforded the opportunity to do this scale and scope of work. It's something I will be eternally grateful for. What Taylor had previously built afforded us the chance to bring in a cast and a crew who were able to tell the Bass Reeves story in an authentic way. What is your final reflection on Bass Reeves? When you see a black man on the screen in this way, so soon after enslavement, it warrants celebration and for the story to be known in this country and beyond. Cibolo Creek Ranch. When you travel to this restored fort in West Texas for horseback riding, hiking, and good old-fashioned R&R, you're going back in time, in style. By Pam LeBlanc. I feel like an extra on the set of a classic old Western as I drive down the long gravel road leading to the main lodge at Cibolo Creek Ranch. Off to one side, a dozen shaggy brown bison clop their way down a rocky embankment into a muddy pond. A vulture soars overhead, riding the heat thermals on a warm afternoon. Ahead of me in the distance, the coffee-colored adobe walls of an old fort rise against a backdrop of grayish-green, cactus-spiked hills. As soon as I step inside the foot-thick walls of that meticulously restored fort, I want to tug off my boots, sink into a leather couch, and stay a while. And the good news? I can. John Poindexter, a wealthy Houston businessman, bid on this property at a courthouse auction in 1989. A third-generation Texan, he wanted to buy a ranch, and the dramatic setting of this one, located about 30 miles south of Marfa in the Chinati Mountains of West Texas, fit the bill. It's situated within day-tripping distance of Big Bend National Park, the Davis Mountains, and Big Bend Ranch State Park. Early cattle baron Milton Favor, who'd allegedly fled to Texas from Missouri after killing a man in a duel, found the spread in 1857. Remote and ringed with low mountains, the land features springs, canyons, mesas, and three historic forts built to fend off attacks by Apaches, Comanches, and bandits. Favor put 20,000 head of longhorn cattle on his new ranch, channeled spring water into canals to irrigate fields, and grew enough peaches to make his own peach brandy. He also ran a mercantile in Presidio, 30 miles to the south, and supplied goods to nearby Fort Davis. Life was good, considering the harsh conditions and remote location. After Favor died in 1889, the ranch passed to his family and eventually was sold. The forts didn't fare well. Adobe walls disintegrated and eventually fell into disrepair. Poindexter wanted to restore it to the way it looked in Favor's time. After acquiring the property, he set to work restacking stone fences, restoring irrigation channels to working order, and building gravel roads. He repaired the adobe forts, too, paying attention to detail. Crews made replacement adobe bricks using local mud and painted them in traditional colors. They tucked air conditioning units out of sight and concealed electric controls and plumbing. Cibolo is a Spanish and Native American term for American bison, the buffalo. And over the years, Poindexter even reintroduced bison, native elk, and wild turkey to these remote hills. Cibolo Creek Ranch opened as an exclusive resort in 1994. Like anybody visiting the place, to me it's always new, always exciting to come here, Poindexter says. I think we've done something semi or extraordinary. We've restored a 19th century property. The art, the sculptures, the landscaping, the brush clearance, the road, the fences, the building, the furnishings, the staffing. It's been a very resource-consuming effort, and I take some degree of satisfaction in the results. Today, Cibolo Creek Ranch is listed on the National Registry of Historic Places. Favor is buried in a glistening white adobe tomb at the top of a small hill behind the main fort. Along with Mick Jagger and Miranda Lambert, guests have included all sorts of seeking peace and quiet, and an inspiring location including Tommy Lee Jones, who shot scenes for the three burials of Melquides Estrada here. My husband and I made the 7.5-hour trip from Austin to the 30,000-acre property by car, but guests with more resources than me, movie stars craving privacy and anonymity. The ranch affords, for example, can fly in and land on the ranch's own 5,300-foot asphalt runway. After dropping our bags in a room in the hacienda adjoining the main fort, we quickly discover some things the ranch's original inhabitants didn't have: a sparkling swimming pool, an outdoor hot tub, an impressive collection of artwork, burbling fountains, and well-appointed rooms. Outside, guests can rock in chairs overlooking a spring-fed lake or scan the skies with a telescope set up on a lakeside patio. "We say the stars are the size of dimes," Poindexter says. "And to take full advantage, there's a fire pit and stargazing parties." We spend an hour after our arrival rambling the grounds. The two watchtowers of the main fort serve as pocket museums. We peruse the displays, stone spear points and arrowheads found on the property, old photographs of the original forts, as well as Milton Favor and his wife Francisca, and an entire room filled with antique weapons, including a cannon and an assortment of rifles. We peer into a small restored 19th-century chapel in one side of the fort and admire the altar along with Spanish, Mexican, and American antiques tucked in every corner. It's immersing yourself in an earlier time, the beauty of the mountains and the majesty, says Poindexter, who lives in Houston but flies to the ranch every month or so to supervise the never-ending stream of projects and soak in the quiet of the desert. "We're trying to make it a tribute to how this country used to look." He checked government archives and sorted through Favor family memorabilia as he tried to restore the ranch to the way it looked in the mid-1800s. He planted native grasses in some areas, and inside buildings he made sure modern conveniences were hidden. Besides the main Cibolo Fort, where I'm staying, there's the even more secluded Cienega Fort, used for large private groups, or the romantic single-room La Marita cottage next to a third fort. My room is spacious and Old West cool, with its own fireplace, a seating area, and a bathroom big enough for a football team, complete with a giant tub, shower, two toilets, and a bidet. Poindexter tells me he's always working on something out at the ranch, and the next day, as I explore a little farther from the fort, I understand what he means. Crews are busy clearing brush out of the creek bed near the sporting clay range. Construction is underway on two new rooms at the end of the hacienda next to the small lake. I'm nursing a torn ACL, so I skip the hiking and horseback riding and hitch a ride on an all-terrain vehicle for a ranch tour instead. We chug up a steep hillside for a view of what our guide says is the second tallest waterfall in Texas. It hasn't rained much lately, so it's more of a silver trickle that spills down a canyon wall, but the waterfall and a small spring on the other side of the fort reminds me that water exists even in a desert. We drive through blooming ocotillo and agave to the top of a mesa, where we get a bird's-eye view of the main fort where we're staying. Lizards skitter out of our way, and a snake slithers into the underbrush. I can see why this ranch, with its wide-open spaces, rocky outcroppings, and cactus-studded hillsides, have been used as a movie set. Scenes from the James Dean movie Giant, along with parts of the three burials of Melquides Estrada, There Will Be Blood, and No Country for Old Men, were filmed here. After the tour, we head back to the fort for lunch and then it's time to really relax. I meet Diana Wassef and Patrick Manian, who operate a tea house in the desert near Presidio and run Big Buddha Bakery in Marfa. They lead us in a meditation and tea ceremony in the fort's courtyard. I realize then that sipping tea isn't about what's in the cup. It's about slowing down, focusing on the sounds of nature, and making a connection with yourself and those around you. Birds chirp and water burbles from the nearby fountain as we drink three bowls of amber-colored pura tea. We often think of tea as an everyday beverage, Manian says. I hope to bring it one notch deeper. I hold on to the sense of serenity that evening when we gather with other guests around the long communal table for dinner. The table discussion swirls around the beauty of desert plants as we sip margaritas and eat grilled quail, mashed sweet potatoes, and pecan pie. We meet an artist from New Mexico, a gallery owner from Marfa, and a doctor from Dallas, all here to revel in a fort no longer used for defense. And as I peek out at the night sky, my mind entertains what could be a scene from a western from long days ago. If a cowboy from the 1850s suddenly walked through the gates of this ranch, he'd feel right at home under this starry, starry sky, just like I do.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from True West Magazine, December 2023 edition. The Arrested Travels of Jedediah Smith by Mark Boardman. His first trip to California featured an unexpected stop. December of 1826 should have been a time of triumph for explorer mountain man Jedediah Smith. He had blazed trails across the West, creating parts of what became the Oregon Trail. The 26-year-old had made his way to California, where he was warmly greeted at the various Catholic missions. But at the time of Smith's greatest glory, he found himself stuck. Smith and his 15 men had spent 4 months traveling from the Great Rendezvous in Idaho to the San Gabriel Mission, about 25 miles northeast of present-day Los Angeles. They had gone through parts of Utah and Nevada and become the first U.S. citizens to traverse the Mojave Desert. Despite some hardships on an unknown desert trail, all had gone well. Until they received an invitation from the Mexican governor of California, Jose Maria de Echeandia. Smith and an interpreter were to visit the governor in his San Diego base. Smith could not refuse, so he made the journey and was placed under house arrest, albeit one of his own choosing. For a couple of weeks, Smith met with Governor Echeandia and waited for a decision on what came next. He was not exactly impressed with the governor's decisiveness. My fate depended on the caprice of a man who appeared not to be certain of anything or of the course his duty required him to pursue, and only governed by the changing whims of the hour. Indeed, the governor asked for guidance from his superiors in Mexico City, and even considered sending Smith to meet with them. It appears they didn't know what to do with Smith either. Echeandia requested that Smith turn over his maps and journals. There was concern that the mountain man was a U.S. spy. Smith deftly got out of that by claiming the documents for his own use only, and that the maps in particular were probably inaccurate. The governor finally decided to send Smith and his men back the way they had come. Smith agreed to that. Sort of. Once the party got beyond the Mexican settlements, they headed northeast, going through and over the Sierra Nevada, across the Great Basin, and on to the Great Salt Lake. Barely surviving their ordeal across the heretofore unknown mountain passes and desert trails, they made their way to the Great Rendezvous of Mountain Men, again in Idaho, in July 1827, with stories to tell of their travels. Smith would later return to California and go further north to Oregon, before being killed by Indians on the Southern Plains en route to New Mexico in 1831. His journals and maps outlived him and were used by countless groups who came after him. True West, December 2023 edition. A Little Town with a Big Agenda by Jana Barmesbach. Trinidad, Colorado won't let go of this 115-year-old gem. Nobody's still around to remember the glory days. John Philip Sousa, Sitting Bill, and traveling vaudeville acts appearing on stage. But there's still plenty of folks in Trinidad, Colorado who remember something just as glorious. So when seats at the 1908 Fox West Theater were offered for sale as a fundraiser to restore the old girl, plenty jumped at it, like Councilwoman Karen Griego, who bought two seats for $500 so she and her husband could always return to the place they'd smooched as high school sweethearts. That doesn't explain why the city of Trinidad decided to buy the theater in 2018 that had been modernized and then abandoned, but it didn't hurt. We've heard lots of stories about first kisses in the balcony, reports city manager Steve Ruger, who said the real reason was because we recognized this as a tremendous asset for our community. The Fox West has always been a major landmark in Trinidad, one of its tallest buildings, the only second-story balcony in the whole area, and seating for 650. Originally, the theater was flanked by a saloon on one side and a drugstore on the other. Modernization converted it from a performing stage to a movie house in 1929. Somewhere along the way, its glorious arch entrance and storefront windows were covered up, and the interior was painted in a style that can only be charitably called garish. Ruger says the pink paint that dominates was the cheapest surplus government paint of its day. We're not the most affluent area, Ruger acknowledges, but we see ourselves as an outdoor tourist destination, and art, culture, and history are a big part of that. The state of Colorado and major benefactors elsewhere obviously agree, as the Fox West has generated $7 million so far in grants. Another $20 million is needed. Historical funds from state agencies and from local groups like Urban Neighborhoods got the ball rolling, along with money from the Boettcher Foundation of Denver. First up to reuse the building are a tea shop on one end, most of the teas are made from local herbs and plants, and a wine bar on the other. There's now a rooftop terrace with great views of the mountains. The city has just received a grant to upgrade the building's infrastructure, and the town's notable A.R. Mitchell Museum recently hosted a show of artifacts and documents discovered inside the 115-year-old building. We're seeing a lot of interest, and we hope this will become a regional venue, Ruger says. So, Southern Colorado, get ready. Little Trinidad, about 8,300 residents, is about to make its mark again, just as it did when Bat Masterson was town marshal in 1882 and when Ina Eloise Young became the nation's first female sports editor in the early 1900s. True West, December 2023 edition. A Little Town with a Big Agenda by Jana Barmesbach. Trinidad, Colorado won't let go of this 115-year-old gem. Nobody's still around to remember the glory days. John Philip Sousa, Sitting Bill, and traveling vaudeville acts appearing on stage. But there's still plenty of folks in Trinidad, Colorado who remember something just as glorious. So when seats at the 1908 Fox West Theater were offered for sale as a fundraiser to restore the old girl, plenty jumped at it, like Councilwoman Karen Griego, who bought two seats for $500 so she and her husband could always return to the place they'd smooched as high school sweethearts. That doesn't explain why the city of Trinidad decided to buy the theater in 2018 that had been modernized and then abandoned, but it didn't hurt. We've heard lots of stories about first kisses in the balcony, reports city manager Steve Ruger, who said the real reason was because we recognized this as a tremendous asset for our community. The Fox West has always been a major landmark in Trinidad, one of its tallest buildings, the only second-story balcony in the whole area, and seating for 650. Originally, the theater was flanked by a saloon on one side and a drugstore on the other. Modernization converted it from a performing stage to a movie house in 1929. Somewhere along the way, its glorious arch entrance and storefront windows were covered up, and the interior was painted in a style that can only be charitably called garish. Ruger says the pink paint that dominates was the cheapest surplus government paint of its day. We're not the most affluent area, Ruger acknowledges, but we see ourselves as an outdoor tourist destination, and art, culture, and history are a big part of that. The state of Colorado and major benefactors elsewhere obviously agree, as the Fox West has generated $7 million so far in grants. Another $20 million is needed. Historical funds from state agencies and from local groups like Urban Neighborhoods got the ball rolling, along with money from the Boettcher Foundation of Denver. First up to reuse the building are a tea shop on one end, most of the teas are made from local herbs and plants, and a wine bar on the other. There's now a rooftop terrace with great views of the mountains. The city has just received a grant to upgrade the building's infrastructure, and the town's notable A.R. Mitchell Museum recently hosted a show of artifacts and documents discovered inside the 115-year-old building. We're seeing a lot of interest, and we hope this will become a regional venue, Ruger says. So, Southern Colorado, get ready. Little Trinidad, about 8,300 residents, is about to make its mark again, just as it did when Bat Masterson was town marshal in 1882, and when Ina Eloise Young became the nation's first female sports editor in the early 1900s. True West Magazine, December 2022 edition. Bandera, Texas, by Peter Corbett. Cattle drive routes and cowboy cahoots make this hill country town a favorite Old West destination. It's no wonder Bandera is a cowboy town. This is where cowboys converged for longhorn cattle drives on the Western Trail to Dodge City and beyond from 1874 to 94. It's where rodeo thrives today in the town's century-old Manchester Park Arena. Small-town Bandera is big for its britches and proudly wears the title of Cowboy Capital of the World. "First of all, we're from Texas. We brag a lot," said Patricia Moore, Bandera Tourism Office Executive Director. "I'm telling you, this town is bold. It's just flat bold." "This century's cowboys have found us in Bandera," Moore added. "This century's cowboys are motorcyclists who ride into town from all over. Bandera is about an hour northwest of San Antonio. Cowboys and cowgirls come to Bandera to enjoy the western spirit of the town and its notable features. That includes dude ranches, bull riding, barrel racing, junior rodeo, and a professional Rodeo Cowboys Association rodeo on Memorial Day weekend. Rodeo is to Bandera as baseball is to everywhere else, according to Moore. There's also country music, honky-tonks, a local brewery, eateries, unique shops, artisans, and a Western Museum in Bandera. The biggest whoop-de-doo of the year is Cowboy Mardi Gras, with beads and boots, a parade, and bands playing at the 11th Street Cowboy Bar. Bandera is home to Arky Blue's Silver Dollar, one of the oldest and best honky-tonks in Texas. The Silver Dollar is in the basement of the Bandera General Store, a 1921 building. It was called the Foxhole in the 1940s. Singer-songwriter Arky Junkie bought the place in 1968 and has performed in the Silver Dollar ever since. Catch him on Saturday nights. A scene from Race with the Devil, a 1975 movie starring Peter Fonda, Warren Oates, and Loretta Swit, was filmed in the Silver Dollar Beer Joint. For local craft beer, Bandera Brewery has a lineup of creatively named beers with rye cultural references. Fat Guy in a Little Coat, Sharks with Laser Beams, and Very Shagadelic Baby, Yeah. The brewery is family and dog friendly. Wannabe cowboys can visit one of Bandera's guest ranches. The Dixie Dude Ranch has hosted city slickers for 85 years on a ranch established in 1901 by William and Zoe Whitley. It's been in the family ever since. They operate on a 725-acre spread 9 miles west of Bandera. The Mayan Dude Ranch is another family outfit. The Hicks family established the ranch in 1951. Guests can ride trails on 348 acres of hill country. In town, the OST, Old Spanish Trail, Cafe, starting its second century of serving hungry guests breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Leave room for a slice of pie and check out the John Wayne Room, which features photos of the Duke and other cowboys and celebrities. Shop in Bandera at the popular Hi-Oh Silver and the aforementioned Bandera General Store. It was a movie theater and the old Cox Dance Hall long ago. Now it carries a wide selection of cowboy boots and hats, jewelry, antiques, souvenirs, and a soda fountain. Don't miss the Spirits of Texas shop with crafts, clothing, boots, books, furniture, and intoxicating spirits, including musician Kinky Friedman's Man in Black Tequila. 95% of the merchandise is made in Texas. Visitors might also want to take a photo on a saddle-broke longhorn steer, take a wagon ride around town, or grab a bite to eat at a chuck wagon that posts up in Bandera. Finally, history buffs will want to explore Bandera's Frontier Times Museum, a storehouse of the town's colorful past. Mm-hmm.